Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Philip Morris, CEO of Proctors. Recent Restore New York grants are funding the Capitol Repertory Theater's move to a new building, and construction is moving forward at Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs. In addition, Philip Morris says that Proctors is making a stronger-than-ever commitment to regionalism in the area and making the economic and cultural atmosphere less separated and more close-knit. We'll talk with Proctors CEO Philip Morris about all that and much more. But first, welcome my old friend Philip Morris.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
I'm good as you can be. So you are regarded in our area as a miracle man because you have not only made Proctors Theater in downtown Schenectady so incredibly successful, but you've taken on a lot of other projects, and that leads us to a discussion of regionalism in the area. So give us the argument for regionalism.
You do it every day. So
I do
other broadcasters, right? So the broadcast world manages to cross all these lines, be they political or psychic, and very few others do. But the region is a suburb surrounded by cities, and that suburb will go anywhere, right? If you live in Rexford or Clifton Park or Niskayuna or Loudonville, you don't really care where you go to do fun, to shop, whatever. That's why the malls are in the middle and the airport's in the middle. And so Proctors has had for a while the mission to support quality education, rich civic dialogue, and sustainable economic development for the health of the entire capital region. So that sense of could we be part of merging, blending, gluing the region, just like broadcast does, is part of what we're trying to do as we've made commitments to CapRep and UPH.
Is it working?
Don't know yet. I have a bunch of examples to say it is. Examples like UPH and CapRep asked us to participate and to help them make change. We didn't go on a buying spree. I mean, we're a not-for-profit organization that got approached to say, you've been successful there. Can you help us be successful?
Now, Philip Morris, you can't use initials on the show. So if you say UPH, you have to tell us what it is.
Universal Preservation Hall in downtown Saratoga Springs.
Right. And that's not all. Give us a list of some of the other success stories, as well as public theater in Albany.
Well, right. The Capitol Repertory Theater in Albany. You know, Proctors itself is a success story, I think. The GE Theater, we recently opened our third floor education center, the Addy, which, in fact, this weekend is doing the second weekend run of a world premiere of a small new musical called Young Jekyll. And it's being done by producers from New York who intend to take it off Broadway. But it's been built by 10 high school students from Schenectady that are part of our theater workforce program who have learned skills of theater technical and have built this show and are running the show. So we're very excited because these students have had this awesome experience at the end of their semester where they actually created a new work and are going to be able to go to New York and watch it if they want. So it's kind of a tickling thing. So those are great successes we're pretty proud of.
So Philip Morris, do you have an elevator?
We do 1, 2, 3, 4 soon.
The reason I ask is because you said on the third floor. And, you know, elevators are important.
Yeah. We have two elevators to that third floor. This is the old Carl Company building.
Yeah.
So the first floor of the Carl Company building is where our cafe is and the GE Theater. The second floor has conference facilities and our offices. And the third floor is now an 80-seat theater, an orchestra rehearsal room for the Empire State Youth Orchestra's CHIME program, which is designed on the Il Sistema program from Venezuela for kids who otherwise would never touch an instrument. They're there 5 days a week. It's awesome. And a video media lab.
It's incredible when you think about what you've done there. Philip, let's take them one at a time. Let's go to, for example, the CapRep in Albany. How did that whole thing come about?
Capitol Rep had financial difficulties. It's had a hard time from its inception getting its financial legs. And the board approached us to talk about some kind of an alliance that might make some sense.
Now, that's very nice of you to say it that way. Did you approach them or did they approach you?
No, they approached us.
Yeah.
And it was not easy. I mean, Proctors is not a wealthy organization. It's gotten to be fairly big, but doesn't have a big endowment. It doesn't have a lot of protection, undergirding. And Capital Rep was a frightening endeavor because its economics are different. First off, its economic business model is different. It's a 50% earned revenue, 50% unearned business model in the theater. Procter's business model was 85, 86% earned revenue, 15% unearned. So the business model is a big difference. But also it had other issues. It had a physical plant that needed a lot of work. It had reached a place where enough people were saddened or unhappy with it over time that it had lost some supporters. But it had an excellent artistic director. It had good product. There was a lot of reasons to think that this was a thing worthwhile. Mostly, though, if that LORT, L-O-R-T, League of Resident Theaters, closed, there would never be another one. Another one wasn't going to start in 2011 or 2012 or 2018. And we watched this in Buffalo as a community. Buffalo, the Studio Arena Theater closed 12 years ago, and it's never recovered. There is no such thing as that theater in Buffalo. So the board of Proctor's pretty much said, okay, if we're going to be a healthy region, then we need to figure a way to support this. I often say it's like we all learned in our first economics class in college about the invisible hand of Adam Smith. That's me taking my hand and making it hide. The dollar would go where it was going to go and it was going to balance out. So not every one of these four cities has the same resources. There's only one SPAC. There's only one thing like the Albany Institute of History and Art. Now there's only one thing like Proctor's and the Broadway stuff the Proctor's does. Well, there's only one LORT Theater, Capital Rep, and that's the only one that would ever be. And if it closed, it would be gone, and the region wasn't likely to revive it. So it was important.
So, Philip Marsh, you are the boss of bosses of these places, which is a very interesting thing. In other words, you take over, let's say, Cap Rep. You have, as you said, a very good director. How much do you have to give them in terms of the ability to be their own bosses without your mini, you know, overseeing everything?
I don't mini oversee anything. That's not the way I operate.
That's my point.
But we, Proctor's staff, does the development and the marketing and the finance and all those parts of Capital Rep.
But you have to say no every once in a while. You have to say no every once in a while.
The artistic part, Maggie runs, and we manage the finances and fundraising.
That's Maggie Cahill, right?
Yeah, Maggie Mancinelli Cahill. Yeah. And Maggie and I certainly talk about our seasons and how they're going to integrate. In fact, the integration of those seasons has been part of Cap Rep's success. When you buy a Proctor subscription, you get a seventh ticket, a chit, in order to go to any one of the Cap Rep shows. And that has increased the number of people going to Cap Rep wildly. And if you get a Cap Rep subscription, one of the shows is at Proctor's. And so it's helped to crisscross across that suburb. A lot of people going across and doing something they might not have done before. Going to an event, a town that they might not have wanted to or had a reason to go, and now it happens. So anyway, Maggie and I talk much about the season, but she decides. It's her season. She builds it. She directs it. I don't interfere with any of that. I deal with the strategy and the building and financials and making sure there's an audience and making sure we stay healthy.
Philip Morris, when we did one of these discussions years ago, we talked about, you know, the gambling dens that were coming into each of these major communities. And you were concerned that when the Schenectady one was built, it might interfere with Proctor's. Has that turned out to be something that happened?
Let's unwind that a little tiny bit, because when we talked, it was before the Schenectady one even picked.
That's right.
So we organized a group we called the Upstate Theater Coalition for a Fair Game. 11 theaters in all three of the state's regions that were going to get a casino, Southern Tier, Catskill, and Capital Region. And the 11 of us argued with the governor's office and the legislature that there needed to be some protections. Those protections were put into place.
And what were they?
Basically, it said there are two things that are in the legislation. An applicant had to prove that they were in some form of relationship with local downtown theaters and were supportive of them, or they had to explain why not, which was pretty strong.
That's harder.
It was a lot harder. And so I ended up negotiating with 13 of the 16 applicants. There were 16 applicants for licenses. 13 of them had agreements with us, MOUs, that basically said we're going to not use exclusivity, meaning if the casino hired a performer, they would have exclusive rights to that performer for 100 days and 100 miles, a very typical thing. Would not use exclusivity against the theaters, would coordinate bookings with the theaters, would not build theaters over 1,000 seats, and would pay us an annual sum to this Fair Game group. So 13 of the 16 agreed, and of those four, not three, but four finally that were selected, two in the Southern Tier, they were all part of the 13 that had agreements with us. So we have now brought those MOUs to contract, and each of those casinos has agreements with that region's, their respective region's theaters and facilities, and they pay into Fair Game an annual fee. It's a total of $1.2 million between all four casinos to Fair Game.
Again, go over Fair Game with us.
The Upstate Theater Coalition for a Fair Game is the 11 impacted theaters in the three regions, Catskill, Southern Tier, and Capital Region. We still work together, though much is regionalized. We still meet twice a year together. And we're actually starting in 2018 a funding program for small arts groups. We're taking 15% of what the casinos are paying us annually to support a grants program for small arts groups. So there'll be $150,000, $175,000 in awards annually for the next decade for arts projects. Anyway, then came the selection of Schenectady as the Capital Region Casino. In many ways, we were in a good position to observe and guess at which casinos would win, because we negotiated with them all. So underneath my blotter at home, I put what I thought would be the three winners, because originally there were supposed to be three, not four. And I was right about those three. I wasn't right about the fourth, but I was right about the three. So I think based on our conversations, the right and best players were selected. Rivers has been kind of remarkable. They're the only urban one. The other ones are destination, suburban, out in the country kind of things. And I think it was a good move on the part of the state to select an urban casino, because I don't know if there's room for any more casinos. I would think not, except maybe in New York City. But the fact that one would test the idea of the integration of any entertainment kind of and cities is cool, because it's going to change Schenectady. It's changed Schenectady as Proctor's changed Schenectady.
But your fears that made you do all this work were not realized. In other words, they haven't hurt you. In fact, listening to what you're saying, they somewhat helped you.
Yes and no. Mitigation is the right word. Have we been hurt? No. But we also are in the position with the Schenectady Casino that they've asked us to do their booking. So we do all the show booking for the casino, the little stuff, the locals, and the bigger stuff. And that means we at least know it. We know what the timing is. We can coordinate around it. The impact has been mitigated as much as imaginable. So that's good.
Well, that sounds great. Now, what's the other side of that? You know, you said yes and no. Where's the no?
It's hard to tell. I'm never one of those people who thinks that the economy is a jar and that the jar is limited in size. The economy is the economy. It floats in and out, and all kinds of things happen. But there is a question about what the limits of the entertainment dollar are. And I don't think there's going to be long-term harm, but I think short-term it had some impact on us and our sales. Our ticket sales.
Why?
Because people would spend their money other ways and test it and figure it out. And so there's a level of when does all that come into a new balance? And we're learning as the facility when that new balance, what that new balance might be. And because we have a good relationship with the casino versus a contested one of any kind, that's not that hard to figure out. We can work together. We've done circus-style shows for many, many years, but sales have declined. And casinos like circus-style stuff.
Define circus just for an idiot like
the
me.
The French or Canadian Cirque du Soleil style.
Yeah.
And we went to the casino and said, this is something that casinos often do, and we're having more difficulty with it. How about we do it together at Proctor's? And they said, yes. Now, there's a mitigation and an opportunity that's just terrific.
How do you do something together?
They will be offering to their loyalty card people. They will be helping establish a bus route and a way for people to come from the casino, go to the show, and go back. It's not far, 3/4 of a mile. Some people in the fall, if it's a pretty day, they're going to walk. But an event that might have had a casino personality is going to happen at Proctor's, and the casino is going to be an advocate and supporter of it and be bringing people to us, not just us booking things for people to go to them. And that's all fabulous. Yeah. So, again, this mitigation efforts are really good because there's a relationship. Otherwise, if there's no good relationship, none of that would have happened.
Have you been keeping an eye on the other places around the state that have either tried to replicate what you're doing or haven't been successful at it?
The other three casinos don't have, as of yet, the kind of intimacy with their local facilities that Rivers does. But of course, the one, Lago, is in the middle of the country and the impacted theaters in downtown Rochester. Tioga is close to Binghamton, but it's still not in Binghamton. And certainly the Catskill one is out in the country, though they have a more closer relationship than the other two with Bethel Woods. But Bethel Woods is summer only. So there's no other example quite like ours because of its downtown neighborhood sensibility. And the other impact of the casino is that the casino was part of the rest of Mohawk Harbor. And wow, I'm amazed watching it get built, get occupied. You know, there's tons of apartments and condos, and they're all occupied. I'm amazed. It's wonderful.
Remind us what Mohawk Harbor is again.
Mohawk Harbor is the 60-acre site that used to be Alco, the locomotive company that the Gillespie Group took on as a brownfield project before the casino. The casino idea was just one of many to occupy and make the economics of that site make sense. There's also, I don't know how many hundreds of apartments and some retail and condos that are all part of it. So the riverfront of Schenectady has gone from 100 years of industry to what will probably be 100 years of entertainment and living.
So, Philip Morris, we may come back to it, but let me move from there to politics. I'm a political scientist. I've been preaching for years that politics is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources. You've done extremely well getting help from the government. Is that hard?
Hard.
In other words, is it difficult? Do you have to get along somehow? Is there a way to do that that you want to put out there so that anybody else going through this, and that's why I'm enjoying this interview so much, because you're the guy who has shown it can be done, but one of the places it has to be done, one was the casino, and the other now is you have to get grants for what you're doing.
So on an operating basis, we don't have any grants. We use earned revenue and philanthropy. We don't have grants of any kind that pay for our utility bills or our shows. That doesn't happen. But we do seek that kind of grant funding for capital projects. And we've had a bunch of them, and we have a bunch of them coming up. The state of New York has a number of methods for supporting capital projects. And we've been successful with those methods. But I think a big piece of that is because we're meeting the state's ambition with those programs. If we didn't deliver what the state wanted, the state wouldn't be supportive. So we've been very successful with Restore New York. Restore New York is meant for vacant properties that have the potential to be renovated to make a substantial difference to a neighborhood or a community. Capital Reps, the new building, which is on Livingston and North Pearl, was vacant, had been an electrical supply shop. Before that was a bakery. In fact, was one of the original Nabisco conglomerates. Years ago became a National Biscuit Company. That vacant building in that neighborhood, which was across from the Ida Yarborough high rise and on the edge of the downtown as it goes into the warehouse district, is a fabulous location and needing investment.
How did you get there? I mean, in other words, how did you identify that space, and who did you have to go to?
So for a while, for about 2.5 years, I looked at 18, 19 properties in Albany for CapRep to consider moving. And I looked at that building because it was just for sale. But I had a lot of columns wooden columns. And I kind of went, this is going to be too expensive for us. Because our guess was that we could raise maybe $3-3.5 million. So I was in a more modest expenditure mode mindset for a move for Capital Rep. Then Steve Longo from the Albany Housing Authority, who is a remarkably creative and open to ideas person, called me up and said, Philip, I want you to come look at this building again with me because there may be an opportunity for some help from New York State's Housing Authority because they want to support projects that support neighborhoods where they have significant housing investments. Pretty smart idea, because so often in our older history with housing, housing was built and abandoned and not made friendly for the community, and so they became dilapidated. And the idea here is to make the neighborhood healthy, which would help keep the housing healthy. So I went and looked at it again with Steve, and with the possibility of support from another source other than our ability to fundraise, the price tag of the columns became something that could go away. You know, that the cost of retrofitting that building could have subsidy that might offset the physical problem that was with it. So with that, we looked at that property more seriously, applied for the support that Steve suggested might be available, and were successful with it.
How much was the whole project?
The whole project, we just completed the design development stage of the architecture. So there are largely three stages in an architectural project. There's conceptual design, design development, where the designs are more thorough, and then the construction documents, where they're biddable, where you can go and say, I want this screw in this hole kind of thing. At the conceptual stage, the number was $7.5 million. At the design development stage, which we recently completed, that number moved to $8.5 million, which we're close to being able to finish the fundraising for.
Okay, let's go there because it's something that always fascinates me. How do you raise money for something like that? How do you go to donors? Who has to be involved?
Oh, lots of people. First off, the boards and the board has to be supportive, and people have to just say it's a good idea. Certainly helps that there was some state resources, almost $5 million, that came into play over the course of Restore, which the city applied for, and the housing project. So it helps. It sort of says, yeah, this makes sense for other agendas. And then we do the research to interview people and talk to them about their concerns and ideas. And I love a saying that our fundraising council for the last 20 years has used with us. If you want advice, ask for money. If you want money, ask for advice.
That's very funny. You obviously have hired grants people over the years. What do you look for when you hire a grants woman or man?
So we've not had a grants person until about five years ago. We did grants out of our hip pockets. You know, we just look at each other and go, can you write this one? Can you write that one? And I'd write one. And Dan Hannafin, our director of relationships, would write one. And then I met a man through my daughter, an interesting man named Justin Knutson. And Justin is a collector and a writer of radio plays. See, we're going to come back to the radio eventually. And I was sort of like, really, Justin? And then I learned he also worked for Henson Puppet Company for a while and is a really fine storyteller. And I read one of his radio plays, and he was not employed at the time. And I went to him and said, Justin, how would you like to be a grant writer? And he went, what is that? And I said, well, it's a really good storyteller with a purpose of trying to convince someone that we're the right place for money to go. And he said, I'd try it. And he's been our grants writer the last 5 years. He's a terrific storyteller. He has a lot of curiosity, very important. And those two are basically what you need.
Now, grants writer is different from development person, the way you're telling the story, right? Development person goes out and asks for the money from individuals and from companies. Things.
Yeah, it's about relationships, you know? And so you build relationships with people and with organizations. And
how much do you do of that?
Well, I do a fair amount. I would say in a year, a tenth of my time goes to visiting people, asking for their support, And it's all very strategic, meaning I have certain relationships, other people in the organization have other relationships. So, you know, it's not my job alone. It's no one's job alone.
Now, how can you get into trouble? I mean, you know, certainly I get into trouble all the time with things that I say or do. Do you have to be very careful about that? I mean, for example, I don't think we'll ever get a grant from Governor Cuomo. So the question is, do you have to be careful about who you alienate? We're lucky. We get a lot of little money from a lot of people. Do you have to watch out where you step?
Do you know who Oscar Eustis is?
No.
Oscar Eustis is the Eustis, E-U-S-T-I-S, is the, I guess, president, maybe CEO of the Public Theater in New York. And he has a TED Talk that is very compelling on the theater. And what he talks about is that the theater and democracy were invented by the same people at the same time. The notion of power coming from the bottom up is a Greek 1500 BC kind of idea. And at the same exact time, the notion of the theater, which was a shift from I'm the person who's going to tell you everything, so you thousands of people in the Colosseum, I'm going to talk to you. It was the shift to a conversation happening on the stage. And so instead of the authority talking to everybody else, two people would talk and everybody would observe. And Oscar talks about this as the natural alliance between the conflict of ideas to reach truth. And that clearly democracy is about the conflict of ideas to reach truth. And the theater has always been one of the tools for that conflict to get exposed and viewed. So I guess I see us in a role of being a critical piece of the notion of democracy. And in that regard, yeah, maybe sometimes we annoy somebody, or I get that, but we're also always prepared to hear, listen to, and discuss and present the other side, because we got to.
We're talking to a man who many of us consider to be a real genius, Philip Morris of Proctor's. Philip, let me go to a different place, or follow the thread. You just mentioned that sometimes you get people mad. Can you tell us one story of somebody who got mad?
Oh, I probably have 200. I mean, you know.
What rises to the top?
Oh, there was a humorous one that rises to the top, and that was when we did Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Oh, yeah.
And the show is wonderful. The movie's wonderful. Oscar Eustis didn't say this, but the second thing of theater is about empathy, is teaching empathy. Because if you don't experience the life of a poor person, the life of a person of color, the life of a gay person, you could experience on the theater and have empathy for it. That empathy helps democracy. So here's this great, great piece about a gay couple crossing the desert. And a woman came out after the show, not at the intermission, but after the show was over. So she went through the intermission and went back in and came out and said, I want my money back. I had no idea this was about homosexuals. And, you know, it's a funny conversation. The box office handled it well, you know.
What'd they do?
Explained that possibly had she come out 10 minutes into the show and it offended her, we would have given her money back, but she stayed through the entire thing. The metaphor was, you ate the entire meal, ma'am. It's hard for us to refund you. And she was okay. It didn't come all the way up to me or become a big deal. But it made me laugh and smile just to think about, you know, the whole piece of all of that. What offended her and how she decided to respond to that offense, which was to stay to the end and then get mad.
The other day, De Niro stood up at the Tonys and used the F word and said, okay, come on now, it's F Trump. And everybody in that theater group got up and applauded like crazy, yelled they wouldn't sit down, they wouldn't shut up. Was that right on his part?
I think that being offensive in this difficult time for our democracy has not had an easy time of it, is not the right approach. I think being clear is, and I suppose using the F word is being clear, but it also is offensive. You know, People have kids that might be watching that and be really offended by it, and I don't get the advantage that that gives anybody. So people often, and I've become more this way, they talk about the president instigating and igniting his base. Well, what did Mr. De Niro just do? There's not a person in that room that thinks Mr. Trump's the best president. We all know that. So he ignited his base. He threw a small bomb out there, and everybody sort of jumped on it. And, you know, okay. And that base versus base ignition thing is going to go on forever. It always has gone on. It's not new. You're a political scientist. You know, it used to be that every newspaper was either a Republican or Democratic newspaper, right? It was right in their title. So it's not that that notion is new. And that's just, you know, how he decided to use the ability to ignite his base.
But just to carry it a little further, you know, there's an awful lot of frustration in this country with Donald Trump laying it out where, you know, using the words. And he stood up and he offered a little bit of hope. That's what theater does so often, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm just talking about the message at the time of a public television broadcast. You know, there's times to be offensive and aggressive, and there's times maybe you shouldn't quite be that aggressive, or the language matters.
Mm.
And that was my point. It's entertainment television at that point, and a small ignition, which worked for some and didn't work for some others, I'm sure.
I'm sure you're right, having opening the mail here at WAMC. Okay, so one of the things we haven't talked about yet is what you mentioned in the beginning, and that is the educational function of your theater and of your theaters. What is that?
So for the last 15 years, we've been building it. The third floor at the Addy at Proctors in Schenectady is now a full-time school for the performing arts. It has this orchestral program, which I mentioned, the CHIME program.
What do you mean
program.
Full-time? What do you mean full-time school? Is
12,000 square feet committed to kids.
But they don't. It's not like performing arts in New York or music and art.
Actually, we're taking the opposite tact. We're trying to go after the technical side of it. Mm-hmm. So the middle schools of Schenectady don't have a theater program. So the after-school theater program is for middle school. The middle schools have this CHIME program now for orchestral stuff. But there are 10 high school kids who are learning the trade and who have been interviewed for jobs, who did the performance of Young Jekyll that I mentioned earlier. And these workforce development students are part of that school too. We're now working too with BOCES, Capital Region BOCES, and
BOCES, for those people who are listening in Massachusetts or Vermont or New Jersey to this radio station.
Board of Cooperative Educational Services.
Yeah, they are a cooperative venture that services
across
the schools.
School districts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the BOCES often can offer a program that the individual school districts can't afford to do. And we're working with BOCES and Fulton Montgomery Community College to consider a PTEC. I actually don't know what PTEC stands for, but they have them in all those states, these technical high school programs, to do a PTEC around entertainment technologies. Entertainment technologies range from the engineering that happens in this studio to the CAD program for designing or building a building or a set on a stage, and sound and video and all the pieces of entertainment technology. I like to tell parents who wonder about coming to our school, their kids in a workforce way, whether there will be work. I say to them, if you go to a movie and you stay to the end, there's 1,000 names of people who have had jobs in that movie who weren't on stage. 10 times, 50 times as many as the ones that are on that stage. So you're right. If your student is interested in the theater to be a performer, their odds of a job are not enormous. Some will do very, very well. So if they have that skill, they should shine at it and see if they can shine at it. But if they don't, but still like the kind of work that happens in the entertainment fields, there are more jobs here that are not on the microphone at WAMC than the ones that are on the microphone.
Sure.
So that's a place to look for work because there's tons of it. And I would argue ever more, you know, as we talked about students learning about journalism or learning about production of video or whatever. There's more and more and more. Every company uses media now just to train their people. And 20 years ago, that wasn't the case.
So Berkshire Theater Festival, Barrington Stage, everybody has an educational component. And the cynic in me says, okay, well, this is something that people will pony up for. And that's one of the reasons everybody does it. What do you think?
If it's not real, sure. If it's real, no, you're wrong. So what does that mean? If your education program raises $100,000 and lets 100 kids come see a show for $5, your cynicism is correct. If the education program is like the Capital Rep On The Go program, which builds a student show done by professionals, puts it in a van, and drives it to 100 schools that otherwise would never come see a show that was professional, no, your cynicism's wrong. This is a real thing, and it's a real delivery of a real service that costs a lot of money.
Philip Morris, you know, as a producer, as somebody puts shows up, one of the things I've always loved to talk about with you guys has always been the role of the critic on the newspaper. You'll remember when David Merrick, you're not old enough, but he was a major producer, and he would stop letting some of the critics into his theater.
I love the critics. Yeah, I love it. Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes Steve Barnes, when we use him as an example, will write something that he just hated something he saw in one of our buildings. And I go, so what? I mean, that's good. That's good. The more ink, the more time that's spent in that debate, in that conversation, where someone can go, you know, I read that and I agree, or I read that and I disagree, or I read that and it was so strong I decided I had to go see it myself. That's all good. I mean, none of that's bad. I refuse to believe that any part of the process of critique is bad. And often, you know, I think we don't know well enough how to critique. I taught a class at Rockefeller College in public policy and arts and culture. And the students often didn't know how to debate with one another. So I did a class that was like an art critique class. And I had an artist come in and I'd set up a still life. And these students who never touched a pencil or crayon or charcoal in their lives, none of them, would be asked to spend an hour and draw that still life. Some of them shocked at the results they got because they'd never done it. And then we'd put them up on the wall, just like a crit class, and would critique them. And I would say to these students, all of whom intended to become county managers, city managers, they're all going to become public administrators. If you can't do this, you can't succeed at your job. You've got to be able to look, make a comment, hear a comment, respond to the comment, assimilate that, and decide whether it's right or wrong. And that's what I'm doing in this art class. Artists know how to do this all the time because they're sticking it out there all the time.
Philip Morris of Proctor's, tell us a little bit about your season. What are you going to be doing next year?
Next year's pretty exciting. Anastasia is going to be teching at the theater for our big tech opening.
What does that mean, teching?
The tech is an interesting process. It's 5 weeks long where the producer builds in our building the show that will go on national tour. Mm-hmm. Because Anastasia will still be in New York City. It's not that they take it out of that. In fact, what they build in New York City is very, very different than what gets built to go on a bus and a truck and travel the country.
Fascinating.
So for 5 weeks, they rebuild the show, they remount it, they rehearse it, they bring all the parts together, the sets, the lighting, the sound, all the parts come together, it gets practiced, the actors and actresses put on their costumes for the first time in our building, it all comes together, and then we open the show, and then they practice putting it in and out of the trucks, and from here it goes to, you know, 50, 60, 70 weeks of national tour.
What do you get out of that?
Three things, and they're not financially very significant, the fact we get nothing financially. Number one, we get to open shows early. Often, Proctors before would not see some of these shows till the second year because we're a small marketplace, the Capital Region. We're not Charlotte or Seattle or L.A. or anything like that. So we get to open them. Number two, we've built a student Broadway tech camp that is every Wednesday during the tech all day long. Through BOCES, the Board of Cooperative Educational Services, the students get a credit and so therefore aren't absent from their home school. They talk to the designers, they talk to the directors, they come on stage and see how the loading happens, they watch the process. And then the fifth Wednesday, they observe the first dress rehearsal or something like that. Maybe it's a Thursday, but a dozen students. Now, in this case, these students are highly interested in the theater. That's how they're selected. They come from all the school districts that the Capital Region BOCES serves, and they get hands-on experience with the professionals. It's an awesome program that has already in 3 years changed some students' life ambitions. And we're real excited about it. So that's the second thing we get. And then the third thing we get is relationships. The producers know us. They'll call us up. They'll talk to us. They'll seek our advice about marketing, seek our advice about promotions. We can call them and say, we'd like to talk about this or that or some other thing. And that relationship matters a lot. So Disney teched Newsies 4 years ago. And it was just kind of an accident more than it was strategic. But when Disney decided to tour Frozen, they contacted us and said, we loved being in the Capital Region, and we loved being in Schenectady, and we want to tech Frozen in Schenectady. Well, you know, from our point of view, move heaven and earth to make that happen, partially for the three reasons I mentioned. The fourth one in the case of Frozen is what they're teching in Schenectady isn't the national tour, but the national sit-down, meaning it's going to go to Chicago and be there for 3 months. It's going to go to L.A. and be there for 3 months. It's going to go to Dallas and be there for 3 months. So the only place in the Northeast that's going to have Frozen in the next 3-4 years is going to be Schenectady.
Amazing.
Which is very cool. Yeah.
That really is amazing. Okay, what else you got this year?
Oh, we have The Grinch, and we have Waitress, which has been very popular. And obviously, we have Hamilton, which, as Jeff Sellers, the producer of Hamilton, says, is both a national treasure and an economic treasure. And he is amazing because he talks about it like that all the time. He knows he is managing something that must be made accessible to people, not just make the most money he possibly can. And he does a good job of balancing those things.
So, Philip Morris, you're amazing. What you've done is incredible. How do you keep yourself properly ambitious? What I mean by that is, you know, we all grow a little older and we all have to decide what is going to make our lives worthwhile. Are you looking at any projects in the future? Say, I think I'd like to do that.
Well, the next couple of years have 5 big projects going on. This summer, we're replacing all the seats at Proctor's and putting in a magnetic induction loop so that people with hearing aids can just walk in and hear the show perfectly.
I don't get it. It's somebody with a hearing aid. What do you mean?
In the last 5-6 years, most hearing aids have induction loop capacity. Sometimes you have to hit a button on the aid. Sometimes you don't. Yeah. And the magnetic induction loop sends the sound that the show sends. So people will walk into the theater.
So it's like having a Bluetooth, in other words.
Kind of. Okay. Though it's a little different technology. Yeah. But the same idea. You don't need to borrow from us, because we do it just on a credit card. We don't charge. A hearing device. Your own hearing aid is the device. And we're broadcasting to it through magnetics.
Okay, so there's a big project.
A big project. That's one big project. We just got our bids the other day back from Universal Preservation Hall. So this week we'll be finalizing the contractor and the work to happen there. So that's a 18-month project, Universal Preservation Hall in downtown Saratoga. It'll be a 730-seat acoustic music room, largely. We'll do other things in it, but music is what it'll shine at. We're a month away from the construction documents. If you recall, the conceptual design, design development and construction docs for Capital Rep. So in August or September, we'll be bidding that project. And so that'll be another job that's under construction. And we are negotiating with the governor's office of storm recovery, because Schenectady and its position with the Mohawk has storm threats, to create a microgrid with our heating and cooling power plant. If you recall, we have a heating and cooling plant that does half of the block of downtown, and this will supply electric generation for those same customers. Those customers include us and the Y, which are places of refuge, which is what the governor's office is looking to sustain. So we will be looking at a huge electric addition to our power plant in order to have a storm recoverable microgrid. Big projects. So for the next couple, 3 years, I don't need any ambition.
Well, Philip Morris, you're a producer. You know, you're a guy who has done marvels, keeping various theater venues or creating new ones open. And you're a professor. So is there nothing else? I mean, I could give you a little bit of a zip and say, do you want to be a newspaper publisher?
No, not really. Yeah, being a newspaper publisher is weird, but that's okay.
I did that. You know, I started the Legislative Gazette newspaper 40 years ago. It's very rewarding, especially when you do it as you do for young people. And it becomes a training ground to do that. So you don't want to run for public office?
No. You know, when I was a kid, I always did. I grew up thinking I'd be a senator. I really did. I grew up looking in the mirror and giving speeches to myself. My mother would walk in and just open the door and look and then close the door and go, oh, he's at it again.
Did you have siblings?
I did. One younger brother.
And did he have to applaud?
Nope. I didn't make him applaud. I didn't want him in the room. It was just me in the mirror. And I ran for city council. I was on the city council in Jamestown, New York, when I was there for 25 years. I was on the council for two terms.
And that where Stan Lundeen was?
Yep, that's where Stan Lundeen was from. Yeah. And Raleigh Kidder, who was on the assembly.
So you were on the city council for how long?
Two terms.
Was it rewarding?
The first term was very rewarding because I tried to cut a consensus in the middle between the Democrats and the Republicans. I was a Democrat, but I tried to cut something in the middle, and the five of us in the middle would pass things rather than fight about them. And that was really rewarding. And the second term, more Democrats won, and there was no middle left. And that was, you know, okay, except that sometimes...
Wasn't as interesting.
Not as interesting, and sometimes the Democrats did dumb things. I mean, people do dumb things, you know, it happens.
So, Philip Morris, remind me how you got from Jamestown to Proctor's.
I applied for a job.
And what was the job?
Proctor's. And at the time, it was a $2 million a year organization.
And what's the budget now?
$27 million.
Okay.
And looking to potentially expand, but they weren't sure. If you recall, because you were here, that was the time of the theater wars, where the media were covering whether Proctor's or the Palace and who would compete and who would get to expand and whatever. It was an interesting thing to walk into.
So how come you haven't taken over the Palace?
No one's asked us.
Okay, I'm sorry. but go ahead. So you got here, and then this miracle that we know as Philip Morris began. Extraordinary work, and people are astounded when they see what you've done. That's got to be very gratifying.
Yeah, it is, but it's a community effort. You understand that. None of this happens. It needs leadership, and it also needs advocacy and support. And, you know, without people saying, I want this to happen, I'm going to stand behind that, none of it would happen. None. Zero.
How old are you now?
63.
Do you get the same questions I get about succession? Of course, I'm 76. So do you get people saying, you know, come on, Philip, who are you training to be you, which is an impossible task?
Yeah, I get that all the time. About 5 years ago, we hired a chief of staff, Gene Leonard. Gene is nearly versed in everything. Probably the power plant's the only piece that might be missing for her. And the rest of the senior staff has been there largely for years. So what I say to my board is, look, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow or decided I'm going to the Caribbean and I'm done.
The good old bus, right.
Or I'm done, I'm going sailing for a year. The place is going to operate just fine. You'll still need to replace me, but you go look and replace me.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not going to be in collapse because these people know exactly what's going on in every inch of the institution. So I'm not worried about it.
I answer the question exactly that way. I'm reminded of our wonderful Judy Gruberg on our board, who when asked, what will you do when he's gone? She always says to them, we'll get somebody else. Which is both deflating, but also a reality.
Right. I mean, and it's not like we're General Electric, or us, that you have all this capacity to have someone in the wings or a choice of four people, knowing three are going to resign because they're angry that they weren't selected. I mean, you watch that and you go, my God, you have to have a lot of money to be able to have three people at the top leave because you picked the fourth one to take over.
It has been my great pleasure, as always, and I hope he'll be back because he has so much to teach all of us, not only in a college classroom, not only so that we can replicate what he does, but also in general, the great Philip Morris. And Philip, congratulations on everything that you've done. We can't wait to see you again.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.